Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Working the Crime Scene, an interview with forensic specialist and author Lisa Black. So now, everybody, here's your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everybody. Welcome to the show. We have a very special guest today. Lisa Black, she's a forensic specialist. She's a member of about every important organization there is, the American Academy of Forensic Scientists, the International Association for Identification, International Association of Bloodstain Pattern Analysts, and she's certified by the American Board of Criminalists. She's testified in court over 50 times in cases. And, oh, yeah, she happens to be a pretty good fiction writer, too. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to see you here tonight. So, just start off, let's say, with the really basic building blocks. You're a forensic specialist, so tell us, what are the major duties of someone who is a forensic specialist?
Well, right now, about 90% of my job is fingerprints, collecting them from scenes or pieces of evidence, analyzing, comparing, identifying, maintaining the database. The rest of the time I'm processing crime scenes or capturing still photographs from video surveillance or that sort of thing. Now, when I was at the coroner's office in Cleveland, Ohio, my major duties were quite different. They were mostly, it was examining victims' clothing, testing for gunshot residue, and comparing hairs and fibers. So, of course, it depends on where you work, what your duties are going to be.
Well, I know that when someone enters a crime scene, specialist, police officer, the coroner's tech, whoever is coming into a crime scene, it's sometimes hard to tell what's evidence and what's just the flotsam and jetsam of life. And so when you get there, how do you decide, you know, what looks important, what is obviously a body and blood and all that's important, but what about other things, and what do you find that's often missed or overlooked by investigators when they're working a crime scene?
Well, that's the hardest and most nerve-wracking part of a crime scene, is because you don't know what's important. So there's always a chance that you're going to totally overlook something because there's no way for you to know that it's relevant to the crime. But what's missed or overlooked, I mean, obviously if it's missed, I wouldn't know about it because I don't know that we missed it.
Right.
But as, you know, as a former hair and fiber expert, it kind of hurts my feelings that, you know, no one nowadays that I know of pays any attention to hairs or fibers anymore. Hairs might be collected for DNA analysis, but they're really only used as a last resort. There are no positions. I mean, if you look at job openings on the American Academy website or such like, there's no positions listed that list hairs or fibers anymore. But you'll see them used often in TV shows, and I use them in my books a lot because they're fun. And, you know, and there's so much you can do with them. There's so much variety to them. I use them a lot, but in real life, actually, they're kind of ignored, like all the old-fashioned kind of trace evidence, like, you know, pollen and all those things that you used to see on Dragnet. It's like nobody looks at that anymore. We all just go straight to DNA, and sometimes that's not going to be there.
Well, I know there's been some controversy about hair and fiber and all that, you know, over recent years as to how accurate it is, and you think that's part of it, that the defense attorney's attacking it, or just that it's kind of fallen in disfavor?
Well, yeah, you can't microscopically,
right,
you know, not doing DNA analysis, you can't say that this hair came from this person. And so, yeah, it's not as helpful as other forms of evidence is. But if that's all you got, you know, then you want to do something with it, and it is circumstantial evidence. And that was always the problem with hairs and fibers, that we couldn't specifically connect them to a particular person. I could only say, you know, they could have had a common origin. And now we've all been sort of spoiled by DNA and fingerprints. You know, no one wants to hear could have anymore.
Exactly.
We want to hear yes or no, which, you know, I understand perfectly.
So, and we've heard also one of the things sometimes people talk about is contamination of, well, both the crime scene and the evidence. And I guess the contamination of the crime scene can almost begin the moment the crime is finished. So what are some of the common sources of crime scene and evidence contamination?
Well, officers, family members, you know, nosy neighbors crashing a scene where they don't need to be. But most often what you'd call contamination is what's already at the scene but not related to the crime. I mean, in a traffic accident, there's skid marks in the road that are from previous accidents, not the one you're investigating. If you've ever cut yourself in your house, you know that, you know, 2 days later you suddenly notice that you left a smear of blood somewhere and you had no idea that you'd done it. People don't change their sheets as often as good hygiene might suggest. But, you know, but at the same
especially
time,
in a hotel.
Yes. I like to say that contamination is not a magic word that means anything you want it to mean. You know, like, say, DNA or blood or something, you can contaminate that, quote-unquote, with a whole lot of things, and it's not going to affect the DNA analysis. I mean, you can mix it with dirt or paint or you know, ink or all sorts of things, and that's not going to change the DNA results. You know, now if you drop some bleach in there, you know, then yes, or someone else's blood, then yes, it will. So it, you know, depends on not everything is contamination that's actually going to affect anything.
Right. And I guess there's also a difference between what someone's practices are in a lab, say, that might cause a problem versus just what's natural, as you said, just you know, what's going to get mixed in
yes.
in life anyway. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, one of the most useful things to find at a case of a homicide would be blood, because blood obviously has both biological things. We talked about that DNA, but blood type, if that's necessary, if that's all you got, things like that. But also, it acts as a liquid, so there's blood spatter analysis that is often used to kind of reconstruct who did what to whom and when, where, and how. When you are called out and you approach a scene that's particularly bloody with spatters and spills and spurts and sloshes and all that stuff, how do you approach it? Do you have a basic philosophy for when you walk in there? What are you going to do, and what are the steps you're going to take to analyze that so that you can look at it both biologically and physically?
Well, what blood tells us is often basic and common sense. I mean, there's a pool of blood around the body, and bloody footprints lead out the door, so that's where the killer went. I mean, not into the room with the snow-white carpet. You know, he went back to the butcher block for a second knife and left a smear where his hand rested on the counter. So it's often pretty obvious what it is. And, you know, after that, I look at groupings of blood stains to see if there's a recognizable pattern, like a stream of cast-off stains or a spatter from an impact or signs of arterial spurting. You know, if there's spurting, then that tells us something about the person's injuries. If there's cast-off, then we'll look at the size of the pattern for a clue as to the size of the object. If there's impact patterns, then I'll start the drawing and the stringing back to a point of origin, which is, you know, that's a long process. And this is if you're lucky enough to get one single clear pattern. Usually they're overlapping. So you've got cast off going this way and an impact pattern in that way, and then you invariably get stuff that just doesn't fit any known pattern that you ever learned about, and you just really can't make heads or tails out of it. So, yeah, blood can be really, really interesting.
So what's the difference in how you would approach say an indoor scene and an outdoor scene. I'm assuming that's going to be pretty different.
So. Yeah, well, especially down here where the weather is kind of severe, not severe in terms of cold, obviously. I mean, I live in Florida. I should say that. I'm speaking from Florida. So we can get torrential rainstorms. We get somehow, you know, 98 degrees and 95% humidity. So when you're working outside, you always want to have sunscreen and bug spray in your car. But otherwise, you know, approaching an indoor and an outdoor scene is the same basic approach. I mean, you decide what's your affected area, you photograph, you sketch, you measure, and collect. You might do things in a different order depending on the weather. I mean, one time we had an outdoor homicide, and I convinced the detective to wait an hour or so until the sun came up to search the surrounding lots, because trying to do it by flashlight or floodlight would just never be as good as doing it in daylight. And I said, you know, there's really no point to trying to do this by flashlight when the sun's going to be up in 2 hours. We should just wait. But the major difference, aside from dealing with the weather, is measuring can be a whole lot more difficult when you don't have two walls to measure off of. You don't have those fixed points. And you're trying to use trees, which might be cut down, or, you know, you're trying to use the road, which is not a perfectly straight line on the edge. And that's the only – and then you have such long distances sometimes. That can make things more difficult.
One of my favorite stories was about a we'll just say someone who is new at this who used a parked car as his reference point. His fellow officers weren't too happy with him. Yeah.
Well, unless it's up on blocks, you know, which in Florida could happen, couldn't it?
Yeah, they need to go out and boot some innocent person's car immediately.
Well, are there any particular, cases that you were involved in that were pretty cool or pretty confusing, and where you had to be a little innovative in what you did at the crime scene to gather the evidence? Anything come to mind that was just fascinating that way?
Well, talking again about bloodstain patterns, the first bloodstain case I had after I had been trained in it, you know, I came back from the class and my boss called me and we had this stabbing case. I'm like, okay, cool, you know, I've learned all about this stuff, I can do this, you know. And I get there and the homicide took place in a garage that was so full of junk you couldn't believe it. I mean, there was stuff piled along all the walls with like a little man cave constructed in the one area with a couch and a coffee table and a TV set and just totally surrounded by stuff. I mean, you know, what you keep in your garage, tools, boxes, the kids' toys, I mean, just everything. And there had been a protracted struggle, so the couch, table, boxes had all been moved out of place or knocked out of the way at some point, but I had no way to know whether they were moved before or after the blood had been deposited. And so I had just been at this class, you know, where we have a wall and a floor and these nice, flat, 90-degree surfaces with nothing in the way. And here, I didn't have a stationary 90-degree surface anywhere. You know, I just stood there and, like, looking at it in dismay for the longest time, thinking, where am I going to begin? And I finally just went with the floor, which by this point resembled a child's finger painting, since that was the only surface I knew that couldn't have moved at any point.
And you use that to do your plotting and your distances and all that.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah. Hello?
Are you there?
Yeah, we
yes,
are here.
Yes, are you there?
Hello?
Hello?
Okay. Maybe we got disconnected somewhere.
We may have lost Lisa in Florida.
Yeah. Well, here's a first for our show.
Yeah, this is good, though. You know, we can go with the flow. You want to sing, Jan?
No.
Hello? Hello, Lisa.
There
are you there?
I think
I'm sorry, if you're there, I can't hear you. I've totally lost you. Call back, Ben.
We're here. Did you get the mute on your phone or something?
Okay. Well, so,
well,
let's say.
Hello?
Are you there?
Yes.
Yes, we are.
Somehow I lost you.
Okay, you're back?
Yeah.
You're back.
Okay. I don't know what that was.
I don't either. I didn't hit anything.
It was the NSA. They're listening in. Well, obviously, you've seen the field change, and, you know, where they use sketches, and now they use, you know, more film and video. They use strings, and now they use more lasers, and they used to chalk the body, and now they don't, and things like that. What do you see on the horizon as far as new technologies in the approach to a crime scene by a criminalist?
Well, obviously more touch DNA.
Yeah.
I mean, state labs are now doing DNA analysis on burglaries and car thefts. I mean, sometimes, not all of them, but that would have been unheard of, I think, only 5 or 10 years ago, at least in our state. It used to be violent crimes only. Of course, again, I think sometimes we get too dependent on DNA, counting on that to solve every crime, and sometimes it just isn't there. You know, if you walk up, shoot somebody, and walk away, there isn't going to be any DNA left. Or if you're a frequent guest in a home or the workplace, and your DNA isn't going to prove anything anyway. So,
right.
But touch DNA is being used more and
more.
Why don't you
explain that to the listeners, what that is and where you find it?
Sorry. What we call DNA is DNA collected from somebody simply touching something. It's not blood, it's not saliva, it's not semen, it's not any other bodily fluid. It's just the DNA from the sweat and oil and skin cells in your fingerprint. And we collect it from, like, steering wheels to see, you know, who drove the car last, or gear shifts, or any object that someone, you know, had picked up and gripped. And the other quickly growing areas, I think, have to do with computers. You know, we're downloading a lot of computers and learning how to do that. Cell phones, downloading a lot of cell phones, because I think nothing's changed human life like in the last century as much as computers and cell phones. I mean, every single person uses them now, and they can have so much of the history and movements of the person inside them. So we use those. Video surveillance, I mean, you know, it used to be only banks had video surveillance, but now people, you know, ordinary citizens have video surveillance on their own homes. So, but it's all, so many of these, there's still a lot of variation in videos. A lot of them just came out of these little, you know, mom-and-pop companies that go in and install it. The 7-Eleven buys it, but then nobody who works there knows how to use it because they don't need to, you know, on a daily basis, and I don't blame them. They don't have a manual. The company's gone out of business, so they don't have tech support. So that can be a challenge. So, but again, like cell phones, they're getting more and more standard, so we're increasingly spending a lot of time.
I am constantly amazed that the bad guys don't understand that your computer and your cell phone are not private, that there is a record, that it's like waving a red flag and saying, oh, look at me. And yet they plan and execute these crimes using computers and cell phones and like nobody knows, you know? Duh.
Well, especially, you know, younger people, because they tweet everything they do. They you know... They text all their friends and tell them, you know, what they just did and where they are and where they're going. And, you know, we just stole a stash from our dealer and, you know, I'll meet you later. And, you know, they don't.
And they send a photograph.
They have no
phone.
Yeah, they do. They literally, and they take pictures of themselves holding the cash. And, you know, you just wonder.
Well, they haven't... The ego hasn't gone out of style.
No, it never will.
So, sort of on that same kind of note, you know, I'm sure we're sure that all the, you know, forensic science drama such as CSI always get it right, right?
Well, I actually haven't watched any in quite some time, so I'm not really up on what they're doing on the shows these days. But except for, I mean, NCIS, Abby on NCIS is probably the most unrealistic forensic character on TV, but she's everyone's favorite. I mean, everyone loves her. I love her. I mean, how can you not love her? I love the character. I love the actress who plays the character. But she's an expert in every single field, runs this entire lab and a sea of equipment. She has every piece of equipment you could possibly need, and she runs it all by herself. And, yeah, that's totally unrealistic. But it's fun, you know. So what are you going to say?
Well, are there any other shows or books that you feel made major errors, or let's do the other side too, any that got it right?
Well, of course, Jeffrey Deaver's The Bone Collector, which I loved, of course, it's a fantastic book, made one error when he wanted Amelia to cut the hands off the victim to get the handcuffs. That was a huge no-no, since while the crime scene is the jurisdiction of the police, the body is the jurisdiction of the medical examiner, and she would have been in humongous trouble if she'd done that. But, you know, it was an important part of character development, so I can understand, you know, how that happened. Mm-hmm. Kind of off the topic of forensics for a moment, my husband is an elevator field engineer, so he notices all the mistakes movies make with elevators, such as you cannot climb out of the hatch in the top of the car because they only open from the outside, not the inside. And of course, cutting the cable will not make the elevator fall, since Elisha Otis invented the elevator safety in 1853. But you know, in the movie Speed, they actually showed that the villain destroyed the safeties, so the car would have fallen, as they showed. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of surprising. Kathy Reich's books are you know, very accurate. She uses a lot of science in hers, and they come out really well. And that's all I can think of off the top of my head.
Well, going back to real life, and I think, you know, a lot of Americans, you know, from the Doug and I are both part of the Crime Lab project, you know, we see there's this vast gap between, you know, sort of public expectation about the realities of how much funding and support labs get and what the average lab out there has looked like. And although I think there have been some changes, there are still a lot of problems. And a lot of those were discussed when the National Academy of Sciences in 2009, they published a major report. Anyone who wants to read it, by the way, can download it from the National Academy of Sciences website. But it's a report on forensic science and saying basically that it was a very fragmented system and it needed to change. I'm just wondering if that report made any changes as far as trace evidence work and other areas of crime scene processing, or did it not change much at all? Has that had any kind of impact on the field?
I think it's created more paperwork, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't see that it's changed what anyone actually does. I mean, because we still, you know, do everything the same way we did, because that's how it needs to be done. But we're trying to find new and more thorough ways to document what we do so it can be reviewed by someone else, so that it can be repeated if necessary, you know, so you have that to back you up when you go into court to support your findings and to explain to the jury and illustrate, you know, how you came to those findings. So, like in Leighton Prince, we've worked up new forms. We're trying to develop systems for recording every step in the analysis process. So, you know, as I said, it hasn't changed what we do at all, but only the accompanying paperwork. And this is, as I said, not a bad thing at all. It's kind of a pain in the neck, of course. You know, anything extra you have to do at work, you're not going to be thrilled about. But the more documentation I can carry into court with me, the better. You know, because usually you go to trial 2 or 3 years after the crime has occurred, and there's no way you're going to remember everything you did or why you did it. So, you know, having the supporting paperwork is always a good thing.
Cool. Well, we're going to be taking a little break here in a minute, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about what you do in the courtroom, what your actual duties are, and how you educate juries and how you get the information out so that the case is understandable. And then we got some other things. We're going to talk about some fiction stuff and some and carry on from there. So we'll take a break here, and we'll be back in a few.
Welcome back, everybody, here after the break to Crime and Science Radio with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Again, today's show is called Working the Crime Scene, an interview with forensic specialist and author Lisa Black. So now, here we go. Back to your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back, everybody, and welcome back, Lisa. At the end of the last section, we were talking a little bit about courtroom stuff, and I know a lot of authors and writers that have this stuff, and they love courtroom scenes. And when they're done well, they're great, and when they're done not so well, they're not so great. They're kind of boring and technical. But in the real world, when you get called upon and you go to testify, I know you're there as an expert bringing in evidence. How much time do you spend actually educating the jury, and how do you go about that as far as what that particular forensic technique is? And how much leeway do the judges give you in doing that?
That's actually something we need to do a whole lot more of in the future. I'm actually working right now on a little PowerPoint presentation that, you know, will explain how we compare fingerprints and, you know, having photographs and everything that the jury can look at. You know, I haven't done a lot of it in the past. Generally, you get on the stand and you answer the questions that the attorney asks you. And I don't know how it's going to go, because you're not allowed to walk in there and lecture. I mean, technically, it's set up that you're supposed to answer questions.
Right.
So you would have to get the judge and the attorneys on board with this to give you some time to, you know, start from the basics and build it up for the jury. And, of course, whether the attorneys are going to want to take the time or whether they're going to want to think you're biasing the jury or whatever, you know, I don't think it's going to go really smoothly. So I think it's difficult. It takes time. It takes patience. You need to be a good speaker, which I'm not, especially off the cuff. And you're going to have to put some time in to really, but it's obviously it's needed, and it's something that we're all going to have to start to work on. And it's an uncomfortable part of the job, but it's part of the job, and we're all going to have to face that. It's like when you're an author, and part of, you know, you're a writer, so you've written this story. Well, part of your job is now promoting it. So even if you're not comfortable in front of a group of people, even if you're not comfortable talking to, you know, readers about your writing, you got to learn how to be. And that's just, you know, the same way with a forensic scientist. Even if you're not the greatest teacher in the world, you're going to have to brush up those skills and work something out so that you can get this information to a jury.
Yeah, I always think back to the O.J. trial, and I watched a lot of it, and they had a four-day class on DNA that was so confusing and so disorienting that, I mean, I understood DNA very well, and I was confused at the end. And I always said, I wish I'd have just had 45 minutes on a chalkboard to explain this thing to them.
Yeah.
But hopefully that's what's going to spin out of the new National Academy of Sciences program, is that jurors will be more formally educated in the things that they need to know, mm-hmm. and an unbiased, and, you know, here, this is what you need to know to actually, you know, participate in this trial. I hope that's where we're going. If not, we're going to have to go to professional jurors someday, I'm afraid.
And, of course, it depends on the case. I mean,
sure.
if you know, the person's fingerprint is on the murder weapon, but it belonged to him or something,
right,
then I don't need to spend 45 minutes educating the jury about fingerprint analysis, because it's not really indicative
right.
of his guilt or innocence in this particular case. So, of course, you know, court cases always depend on the circumstances.
Well, before we get into the fiction stuff, I have we mentioned off the air a little bit about the Wayne Williams trial, the Atlanta child murder that was convicted,
mm-hmm.
and we talked about hair and fiber evidence, and he was actually convicted on hair and fiber evidence. They just found a constellation of fibers in association with him that actually traced back to carpets and cars and trunks and stuff that, you know, who else would have had this combination. Can you talk a little bit about the weight of evidence? I mean, we know that fingerprints and DNA are pretty much dead solid perfect as far as identification if they're properly collected and properly analyzed. But what about all the other evidence out there, the hair and the fiber and the tool marks and the other things that enter cases? How do you apply weight to them?
Well, that's one of the reasons they're falling out of favor, really, and that we kind of use them only if we have absolutely nothing else, because you don't really know how much you can how much weight you could put on them. Say with fibers, I mean, I can say that these two fibers are identical. They're both nylon. They're both the same diameter. They're both the same color, but that doesn't prove it came from the suspect's sweater, because I have no idea how many sweaters were manufactured. That fiber may be used in other articles of clothing. I don't have any way of knowing how much of that has been manufactured, how much is in the area, how much is likely still in circulation today. Maybe it's a 10-year-old sweater. So I can't give the jury, you know, this is a 99% chance that this came from the suspect's sweater. And unlike TV, this is one of those, you know, where TV doesn't get it right. We don't have databases of that information. We can't hack into Macy's sales records and see how many of this sweater they sold. I'm fairly sure that would be illegal to do that. And yet they do it on TV all the time. They get all their, you know, all their sales slips, and they know exactly how many bottles of Chanel No. 5 they sold out of, you know, the Miami Glades store, and this is who bought them in their driver's license photo. I mean, you know, you're not allowed to do that. Macy's doesn't really want its sales figures to be, you know, completely known, and Chanel doesn't really want its formula published to every crime lab in the country. So, you know, that kind of thing doesn't happen. And now I've gotten totally off the subject. How
that's
to weigh
great.
Evidence.
We're all about getting off the subject.
how do you assign? You know, how circumstantial is circumstantial, and how significant is it? And so that kind of thing, you know, it is circumstantial. Let's say a shoe print. It's from a Nike Air size 11.5, and that's, you know, what the suspect wears. It's not a good enough print to identify it to that particular shoe, but it's still significant, you know, or is it significant? Circumstantial is all just, you know, pebbles on the side of the scale. They have to add up, and you have to, the only way to present it is you'd have to tell the jury, I can't say that this is a suspect's shoe that he was wearing, you know, but it's the same size and the same color. And that it does kind of put people in a bind, because how much weight can you give to that? You know, the jury has to decide on their own, and that's not really fair to them.
Exactly.
I wanted to just, if I may ask, if you've seen over the time that you've worked in this field, say both in Ohio and in Florida, a change in how law enforcement perceives forensic science?
That's difficult for me to say, because in Cleveland, I worked at the coroner's office, so, and now I work in a police department. So it's, you know, a little different. And in Cleveland, pretty much everything we worked on was a homicide. You know, now the little town I live in is very safe, which is nice. But, you know, we have maybe 4 homicides a year. So it's quite different set of crimes. I really couldn't say how much they all want you to help. You know, and if you don't help, you know, they're disappointed, but, you know, that they get over it. I've never had, like you see on TV, where detectives, you know, pressuring you, this has got to be the guy, you know, you got to tell me that this is the guy and everything. It's like, no, fingerprint didn't match, sorry. They're like, oh, okay, well, we'll first try. You know, it's just another day. You take it in stride, so. But, you know, yeah, they're not, but you're not, at the same time, you're not a cop. So
right.
We always say we're not sworn officers, we're sworn at. So you can be helpful, but you're not in the same category as they are. So there is that, too.
Well, let me ask, these years of working crime scenes and all this, how have they affected you personally? I mean, what? How do you see that you've changed over the years? What have they done to your psyche, as it were? I mean, if you want to talk about it.
Not much, and I always hate to say that because it makes me sound cold. But I think you don't get into this line of work if it's going to make you depressed. I mean, again, unlike TV and books, we're not all obsessed with the job. I don't take it personally if a crime isn't solved, because I'm just one part in this whole process.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes it's really easy to see what happened here, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes the killer has taken off to Arizona before the crime was even discovered. You know, it's not my fault. I'm not going to take it personally. So, you know, it doesn't really affect me that much. It doesn't keep me up at night. I don't know, you know. As I said, it makes you sound cold. It has.
No.
It will.
No, it doesn't.
It will make you. I think it can make you a little paranoid. Yeah, I'm real careful about locking doors. My first week at the coroner's office in Cleveland, we had a family of five come in dead of carbon monoxide poisoning, and it was right before Christmas. So, I mean, I stopped on the way home that night and bought, feel like, two of the best carbon monoxide detectors I could possibly find. So you do become aware of how easy it is to die.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm not real sentimental about death, but I don't think I ever really was. So
now,
I'm not sure
it
how
doesn't
that's
make
much
you cold.
Change.
It makes you professional, and I think as a physician, you know, you have to do that too. You obviously bring it home with you, but you don't dwell on it. If you did, you wouldn't last very long. It'd drive you crazy, and that'd be the end of the story.
Yeah, yeah. It's like then you're not doing anybody any good.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I also think the ideal person in a pathology lab is interested, you know, in it. It's a matter of really, you know, at least intellectually being interested in it. It doesn't mean you don't feel anything or respond to anything or feel glad that you got up the next morning.
Yeah, it's focused. Yeah.
Yeah, you want somebody to be after the answers there, I think. You know, if they don't want to be, then they're as you say, they're in the wrong line of work.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk fiction a little bit. In your opinion, if someone's going to create you as a character in their book, I mean, what kind of characteristics would make a good forensic specialist that you would see, well, not only in fiction, but in the real world, but particularly in fiction, we're going to talk about for a while. But what kind of characteristics should that person bring to the table?
Patience.
Yeah.
A lot of patience. You have to have a lot of attention to detail and a high tolerance for tedium. I mean, a lot of what we do, of course, you're not going to include that in a book, but a lot of what we do is very routine and boring. I mean, you might collect 68 pieces of evidence at a crime scene, and you have to write out an evidence label for each one. You know, every other week I have to sweep and mop the lab because we can't have unauthorized personnel in there. I mean, it's just, you know, housekeeping duties as other duties as assigned.
That's an interesting tidbit.
you might have, 30 fingerprints on one 2-liter bottle, and you have to photograph and analyze each one. You know, you don't have to have a PhD in genetics, but you do need to be comfortable with science. You have to be dogged enough to pursue every way to obtain evidence, but, you know, as I just said, you can't take the course or the outcome of the investigation personally. You have to be confident enough to go into a court of law and say that you're right, despite what one or the other attorney thinks, but not so overly confident that you get yourself in trouble. You know, you have to be able to be surrounded by people under stress without getting stressed out yourself.
Well put. Well put. But, you know, you mentioned earlier that you use some fiber evidence and stuff like that in your books. What other stuff, you know, that you take from your day job into your writing? What other techniques or what other fun things or bits and pieces of cases you've worked have you brought into your novels in the past or in the future?
Well, like I said, I do like to use hairs and fibers a lot because they're visual and they have a lot of variation. And but I get to use new equipment too. So sometimes I'm reading the journals, or we get something, or I hear something about something at a conference, and then I can kind of be on the leading edge of that piece. I haven't gone into detail about downloading a cell phone yet, but I've commented on the limitations of video surveillance. I'm kicking around some ideas for my next books about computer analysis, tracking emails, but mostly I just like to add in the tiny details, the stupid little realities of working with evidence stickers or crime scene tape or tiny, tiny pieces of evidence. The things you'd only know if you actually had done the work. And, I think readers like getting the real feeling of it and not just the glitzy stuff they see on TV.
Well, tell us about your latest book, which is The Price of Innocence, right?
Yes. That just came out last November. And The Price of Innocence begins with Teresa and her cousin Frank caught in an explosion, possibly aimed at this local inventor entrepreneur. He's sort of like the Northeast version of Bill Gates, and named Bruce Lambert. And so she's ignoring her bruises and forced to hand over the investigation to the feds, but she tries to dive back into normalcy at work and is working just a routine suicide. And the cop on the scene with her is assassinated nearly at her feet. And these two apparently unrelated cases begin to move closer and closer together as Teresa encounters the unpredictable world of methamphetamine production and an attractive and mysterious man, a circle of new money and power, and a conspiracy of silence that goes back 20 years.
Wow.
Mm, I
sounds
like that.
Both complex and enthralling. Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Now, what's next? I understand you have a new book that's going to come out later this year, August or something like that. Tell us a little bit about that. What's it titled? What's it going to be about?
Yes, it's called Close to the Bone, and it should be out in August. And in that book, the action invades Teresa's very sanctuary as I move the murders actually inside the coroner's office.
Mm.
Or the medical examiner's office. And her coworkers become victims. And of course, this is on her own turf, so she's both in danger and, trying to protect the safety of her coworkers and find out what's going on at the same time.
Cool. Is there a book out there that you wish you had written that somebody else wrote?
Gone Girl?
Yeah. Harry Potter, yeah.
Pretty much all of Brian Freeman's work, Defending Jacob, who wrote it escaped my memory at the moment. But, yeah, there's lots of books out there that I wish I'd written.
Yeah. Who do you read mostly?
Lisa Gardner.
Yeah.
Her latest Jeffrey Deaver. Great. Yeah, Michael Connelly. All the greats.
Yeah.
Now, any public appearances coming up or things where people can meet or see you in the near future?
This weekend, FluteFest. We'll be at FluteFest at the end of February. Beginning of March is it's a mystery writers convention. It'll be in Orlando. It's put on by the Mystery Writers America, the Florida division. It's a wonderful conference. And that's about it. I think I have some like some small local things, but it's FluteFest is the convention that I'll be at this year.
Cool.
Hey, Lisa, this is John, I never pop in, but I do have one question while you guys are talking about books. Is there one character that you would like to pit against a villain that maybe someone else wrote that you would like to try to tackle in your book to have your protagonist kind of take them on and see if they can, take them out?
Wow, that's a really unusual question.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, I'm kind of a really unusual
person,
so that's what you get with me.
Yeah. Gone Girl,
yeah.
I think I just, well, I can't really say anything because I don't want to give away the ending for people who haven't read it.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I would definitely have a different ending for that story if I could.
I think most people would, but still, it is what it is.
Yeah. But yeah, no one else is popping into mind at the moment.
Okay, cool. Well, this has been great. We enjoy you coming here and talking with us. We'll have to do this again down the road.
Thanks.
And keep writing and keep doing the work. And I always tell people that on the websites, my website, the Crime and Science Radio site, which is crimeandscienceradio.com, we will have links to this up after this. We will have links to all the past shows. We'll have links for further study on these topics that we've discussed today, and links to Lisa's website and her books, so go buy them. Again, great having you here. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. Hello.
We'll see everybody next show.
Bye.